As the jacket sank in the sea and the boat pulled to the end of her tether, the tiny craft jerked, slowed, and swung about lazily, pointing her bow into the wind. Perfect. We had a good line, and the jacket was just heavy enough to sink 8 or 10 feet in the water in fairly light wind, 4 to 6 feet in a heavy wind. In fact, the wind had to be terrifically heavy, which it was a time or two, to draw the jacket to the surface and collapse it. This happened in blows that I estimated to be 30 knots or over, but we didn't have a lot of wind of that force. Under average conditions, this improvised sea anchor cut our rate of drift to practically zero. I estimated our drift, with the sea anchor rigged, to be not more than 1 knot with 16 knots of wind. It held the bow of the boat directly into the wind, thus materially reducing the area of boat offered to the wind's driving force, while at the same time the jury anchor exerted its drag. These two factors combined most satisfactorily. Now we felt quite heartened and more the masters of our fate. 1,000 disasters could still happen to us, and food and water were still as unattainable as the stars, but at least we had conquered one serious problem. We all felt more fit to tackle the others. Tony, who had been the most despondent, perked up as soon as he discovered that I could now control our little boat. He began to take as great an interest in our progress as any of us. This same day, the wind shifted around to the north again, and in a few hours veered to the east. It seemed that the winds were most variable in this area. Our chart shows that we spent the first few days describing circles, as I had feared. We were beginning to notice a dryness of our tongues and throats. There was no moisture coming from our salivary glands, and a withered feeling in our mouths made it hard to swallow. We had all taken great quantities of salt water in our first plunge into the ocean when the plane sank from under us. We had been afraid at first that swallowing this salt water would immediately cause us to suffer unbearable thirst, but we did not find this to be true. Perhaps in this particular instance, this early lack of adverse reaction to salt water was due to the fact that our systems were able to assimilate immediately the mineral content of the ocean we had consumed. Nevertheless, though we were not yet suffering greatly from thirst, we knew our systems must be craving water, and we were worried. There were great areas of sea open to our view. Here and there, far off yet seemingly near, we could see gray and silver streaks between the waves and the darker clouds just above. Rain. At numerous points we could make out what we believed to be line squalls, rains along the line of wind change or cold fronts. Many times we thought one of those squalls would surely hit us and we could get a drink, and many times we seemed to sail right between two showers. But the sun still shone on us. The night arrived surprisingly, as always, in this latitude. We watched the great red sun sink in silence. The sea this evening was dappled with tiny gold-tipped surface waves on which a bird occasionally lighted as if coming home. We felt lonely. The tiny topmost yellow sliver of sun hung a second, then dropped, and suddenly it was twilight. Behind us, a star gleamed. "Well, Henry," Tony said promptly, "time to put on the pot." Why that phrase didn't get under our skins after its 500th repetition is one of the minor wonders of the voyage. In the gray morning of the fifth day, we realized, fully and definitely, that our force had left us behind. Tony said it. "They aren't coming back, fellas." This time, I couldn't think of anything to say. My eyes checked every inch of the little boat from habit. Jean, on watch, was sitting on the forward thwart, tirelessly scanning the sea as it unfolded in the rising daylight. He looked at each of us without expression, swallowed, and stretched a grin. "Well, shucks, ours ain't the only ship on the ocean." He turned his sharp blue eyes back to their patient vigil. This brought Tony's volatile spirits up again. "Some convoy? Why, hell!" We chewed this over a while. Shortly, the sun went to work. Jean sighed and touched his long, tender nose. Tony automatically began flipping water onto Jean's blouse. I sat and dourly regarded the raw red circle where my wristwatch had been. This spot never tanned. It repeatedly burned to blisters, peeled, and burned again. The rest of the morning passed in silence. Each of us was occupied with his own thoughts, and they must have been uniformly gloomy. Over and over I took stock of our situation. In a few hours I would make the fifth pencil mark on the gunwale. 5 days without food or water. 5 days, the three of us crowded together in a space not much bigger than the inside of a bathtub. 5 days with no sleep by night, and a pitiless torture by day, all day long, as the sun's burning rays bit viciously into our hides and boiled out the remaining moisture. 5 days of turning our suffering skins, like basting fowl, to baths of stinging salt. 5 days, and how many days ahead, of nothing to keep us alive but the sinew that was now wasting from our bones. I shook my head like a boxer who suddenly catches himself being counted out. Time to put on the pot, old boy. Boys, I said. They stared at me, Gene absentmindedly fingering his ludicrous young beard, which was stiff with salt. All we've got to do now, I said, trying to make my voice strong and confident, is keep going south and west, and we'll either be picked up or run into an island. It isn't easy, but it might be worse, and if we stick together, I have a feeling we're going to come out all right. Let's shake on it, Gene said. So we shook hands all around, and things seemed better after that. Before evening, the three of us were sitting dejectedly silent. Then Gene made a suggestion. It might be a good idea, he said, not meeting our eyes, to say a prayer. We discussed this seriously. We found that we had all been reared in some religious atmosphere, but that we had all drifted away. It had been many years since I had been inside a civilian church, but I sometimes attended Sunday services held by the chaplain aboard ship, when my duties permitted and I was not going ashore. We all concluded that a word of prayer wouldn't hurt anything. So we sat in the steaming little cup that our boat had become and bowed our heads beneath the cruel tropic sun. We each mumbled a few words of our own awkward choosing, calling on our God to bless our loved ones back home, over whom we were more concerned than ourselves, and asking for a little rain. We were all quite skeptical about the possibility of any answer to our prayer. "Well, now we've done all we could," Tony said. "Gee, give it a chance," Gene answered impatiently. I called on my store of proverbs. "God helps those that help themselves," I said. "Well, come on, rain," Tony challenged. "Or maybe it ain't gonna rain no more, no more." We lifted our voices lustily at that and sang, "It ain't gonna rain no more," as far as we knew the words, which wasn't far, as if by our false cynicism we could put a reverse hoodoo on the elements. At least we were all laughing again, which we hadn't done for some time. Despite our elaborate irreverence, there was no denying that the prayer had made us feel better. Gene, who had more piety in his nature than either Tony or I, took evident satisfaction. His mind now was obviously clean of worries or self-reproaches. For a time we made a game of flinging handfuls of salt water on each other to cool our chafing bodies, but soon in the quivering heat we again fell silent and welcomed the evening. That night, it rained.